Welcome back to Midwest Beats. I'm Tom Lounges, and Mitch Michaels has left the building, just like Elvis. But with us right now by phone, calling in from Los Angeles, Dr. Sandy Kapoor. Are you with us, Doctor?
Yes, I am. I am from Los Angeles. Yes, absolutely.
I appreciate you taking time with us today, and we're going to talk about your new book, and I also want to touch a little bit on this opioid epidemic that everyone is talking about that's impacting America. But first, let's focus on the book. You just released it.
It's been out about a week. I just did a big signing in Hollywood yesterday. So it's been a nice release this last couple of weeks. So
it's called Trust Me, I'm a Doctor: My Life Before, During, and After Anna Nicole Smith. Now, that was a very interesting, to say the least, time in your life. You were her doctor, her general physician, as I understand, and somehow got thrust into the middle of all the scandal, and you have been exonerated and found innocent and everything. But what was that all about?
Well, it was really about being in the wrong place at the wrong time, or just in a sense being a personal physician who dealt with patients with chronic pain and several patients in a practice, but having a celebrity such as Anna Nicole Smith, who was very publicly followed and with scandal, et cetera, and just I got thrust and swept up into the media circus really around her, but I was merely her primary care doctor and also did help her manage chronic pain throughout the years. And that was, everything was sort of misconstrued into this big avalanche of illegal prescribing and prescribing to an alias, et cetera. So it was a government approach, a state approach to kind of trying to make an example of a physician using celebrity to address the issue of opiates, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Now, we saw a similar situation more recently with Michael Jackson's doctor, and it also happened with Dr. Nick from Elvis. It seems like everybody goes right to the physician, like it's like you can control these people.
I think what it's hard to see, when you write a prescription for an antibiotic, people can take it wrong and,
right,
and misuse it and have complications or issues with it. It becomes a much more of an issue with substances such as, pain medicine. The truth is that, Anna Nicole Smith was on a stable regimen of methadone, which is not generally it's not given for heroin withdrawal all the time. It's given for chronic pain. It's been around for, 60, 70 years and used for pain. And it can be very effective. So there's a lot of misinformation out there in terms of how you manage chronic pain. I was a bit of a scapegoat in that sense. If Anna Nicole Smith wasn't who she was, then this wouldn't have been a trial. It wouldn't have been a public event. It probably just would have been brushed under the surface. So it brought to light a very volatile situation, in terms of physicians and patients and the responsibility, really, of how people take medicines or take over-the-counter stuff and mix it with the others and have bad interactions happen.
Now, you started out, as I understand, in the book, around 2003, 2004, you basically took over for a retiring physician. It was a very small family practice. How did you wind up getting in the thick of all the celebrities? You've had others besides Anna Nicole Smith.
Well, it's whatever. Anna Nicole Smith lived in Studio City. She was part of the practice with older people, younger people, and it really wasn't a celebrity-filled practice. It was just whoever was in the area. One of the, listening to the rock and roll music, and it reminded me of, Ronnie James Dio was a patient of mine during around the time I was in trial, and I helped him through his cancer treatment, and fortunately he's lost his life. But it's whatever comes your way. He lost his life, but we and his widow, we formed a cancer foundation for screening, and we've raised over $2 million. So there's the positive aspects of what celebrity can bring to a community But you got to take kind of the good with the bad. It's all about just what's in your community. I mean, I'm in the thick of the entertainment industry here in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about Dio. Now, that's a tragic story. I had a chance to work with Ronnie a couple of times, and you mentioned that Wendy, his widow, has moved forward in a positive sense in his name. What's your role in that, and how long was Ronnie in your care?
Now, Ronnie was in my care for I used to take care of actually Wendy's mother. So, Ronnie just never came to the doctor, never got checked. So he was kind of there. We did some work when he traveled, too. He traveled, and we did some immunizations with a group in the band when he was with the Dio band. But I developed a family relationship with taking care of his mother-in-law and Wendy. And, about 9 months of sort of really since diagnosis till when he died and taking care of him in Houston, and actually flew out with Ronnie and Wendy. And, the time that... He was sick. He kind of voiced his opinion. I wish I would have gotten checked and really had some screening done so that I wouldn't have to catch, stomach cancer in its later stages. And so it was, his sort of wish, too, in a way, why we put it together. So I co-founded it with her, with Wendy, and a large number of people of her colleagues in the entertainment business. Music business to form this foundation that is based in his honor to help screen other people from getting cancer and trying to find early interventions if we do find it and stop cancer before it starts. And Wendy's been, the day after he passed away, we were right into doing forming this fundraising group. And so that's one of my passions that has been one of the things actually that got me through the trial, taking on the reasons for the compassion I have for working with the community. He was aware of the trial and he was obviously upset with it, but I just kept going and doing things with for the good of the community.
How far advanced was Ronnie's cancer when he came to see you?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of men are dragged in by their wives it was a stage four when he came to me. Finally, with he's had these symptoms for some time, blowing them off to acid reflux, et cetera. And so, people are afraid or don't have time or, don't have a relationship with a doctor sometimes that they feel open enough to, or they feel they're a hypochondriac or something like that. And that's kind of one of the things that I think you, as a primary carer, knowing your patients, you have to, you have to try to get people to be open and honest about what's going on with them, and prevention and getting screened getting checked.
And again, that foundation is called the Ronnie James Dio Stand Up and Shout Cancer Fund. You can find out more online at www.diocancerfund.org. And definitely, Ronnie was such a good guy and a good humanitarian. I remember him telling me about him and Wendy had founded, I think it was called Children of the Night, where they would take runaways and misfit children, so to speak, that had come to Hollywood with stars in their eyes and wound up being prostitutes or drug addicts, and they would help fund them to get clean and get back home safe. And I just thought that was so amazing. And, when he passed and all those people were protesting, because he was a metal singer and this and that.
Right.
I thought if you really knew the man, and what he stood for, they wouldn't have been doing that. And
I mean, it's a lot of what people don't understand. I mean, he was 40 years in the career, and he was good to the core. I mean, so many organizations, animals, and farming in other countries, farm aid, these kinds of things. He's been doing that, and Wendy has been doing that all his life. And people sometimes don't focus on those things in terms of public people. Even Anna Nicole Smith had a very big charity towards children and children with cancer and children. That's never talked about in the media ever about her. It's about her drugs or her, you know, her boisterous, you know, it's never about real issues that are there, that she was a, you know, helped kids with cancer and supported them and did activities with them. And so parts of why the book is relevant in the sense is it talks about another side to what that story was, and another angle to really what there is behind celebrity, where we really don't understand, or we see what the media presents to us.
Kind of a peek behind the curtain.
Exactly. Or just, and also it's from my perspective. It's from my perspective of what it's like to take care of patients that are complex, or they have, more issues, or just issues that are, you know, and also played out in the media and played out publicly.
The trial lasted at least, what, 2-3 years. Why did the witch hunt last so long? Why was it so hard to prove the fact that you hadn't done anything except do your job and prescribe the medication she needed?
Well, I think what happened is it was part of an agenda that the governor, the attorney general at the time, and the LA DA's office, Los Angeles DA's office, had to as a platform to help Jerry Brown get elected, had decided this is what they were going to do, and so that's why it was timed over. This is, of course, my opinion, but it's well known that political manipulation occurred, and it, you know, became this agenda, and that's what they were going for. And it took a jury and several months to extract me from, you know, this sort of conspiracy. I hadn't even met one of the other doctor who was her neighbor. I had never met her before, yet I was somehow, you know, I hadn't even seen her for about 8 months and treated her before her death. So it was a lot of things strung together and, thrown into a pot, really.
How did this quagmire of bad press and witch hunting affect your practice? Were you able to continue on during this?
Remarkably, I was able to continue on, and my patients stayed very loyal. And, a lot of older patients, a lot of patients that were vulnerable would not do well if I was not there. I mean, a solo practitioner, I took care of a lot of older patients who were very dependent on me. And luckily, I was able to, their support actually was one of the things that helped me get through it. And my local reputation was just word of mouth. It was a good thing. I never made any, people like Wendy, and they came during that time to have me take care of him during his cancer treatment. So, I mean, it was locally a very, you know, people were very supportive, and that colleagues, other physicians, and were very supportive, and I think that was what got me through, and I've continued to thrive in my practice after all the dust settled.
So has the media circus settled? Is it all over and done as far as you're concerned?
Well, I mean, it's great that the book is coming out now, because it sort of does hopefully bring some closure to a very, a big change in my life in the life. I think the message is really an important message because it's from a physician's perspective. Doctors in America are sometimes, we're sidelined, and, especially in the context of all the talk about healthcare, we don't really have a voice, a real voice. And I think that this book offers physicians like myself or a perspective.
If you just tuned in, we are talking to Dr. Sandy Kapoor. He is a doctor in Los Angeles. He's also an author now. The book is called Trust Me, I'm a Doctor, My Life Before, During, and After Anna Nicole Smith. It is coming out today, correct?
Yesterday. Yes,
yesterday. And you can find it where? How do we get it?
It's on CreateSpace, which is a self-published, or Amazon. It's on Amazon.com, so it's available that way. It will be in stores hopefully in the next several weeks.
Okay. Now, it's not a very big book, but it says a lot. There's a lot packed in the pages. How long did it take you with being a practicing doctor and everything else you've been going through, how long did it take you to sit down and actually put this together? And was it cathartic?
Well, the actual book, I started writing putting it together about a couple of years ago. But actually what I had written, and the book is in a journal or diary form, so meaning that I wrote a lot of it during the trial, during the time that I was, you know, in the public eye getting raided and having, dealing with the press, et cetera. So it's partly a memoir, but it's partly just written in real time. And so it wasn't, you know, I had written over 500 pages before I, you know, sat down to sort of put it in order and edit it. So it was difficult in times. It took me about 2 years to do it outside of work and time. And I hired a writer who helped me to edit it.
Was when you first started making the notes and keeping the journal, was the thought to create a book at the end of it all, or was it just something to keep your sanity and keep track of everything?
Well, I think it helped me. One of the things during the time where the DEA and they descended on my house as a raid that was, you know, with helicopters, et cetera, they took my journals and my diaries that I'd been keeping before that. So it became part of what they used against me in prosecution. So it was sort of an exercise, and I did think about writing a book then too, because it's so invasive, it's so bizarre that you need to have your diary stolen. You worry about your parents reading it or something, but you don't really think about the government or the prosecution, you know, reading it and using it against you. So it was, and certainly it was a way to cathartically express your feelings and thoughts, and really about being honest. And I think honesty, and it's a very revealing book in that sense of taking away all the barriers, and, you know, as my privacy was destroyed in terms of the invasion of my privacy. But I have nothing left to sort of, you know, being honest and true to yourself is what really helps you to heal, and I think that did definitely help me heal.
We saw the big trial with O.J. Brought to television and miniseries, and of course, on Nicole Smith was just as celebrated of a case about the same time, actually, in that same era. Do you think this book may lead to any kind of production?
You know, people have talked about that. I mean, I am in Studio City or Hollywood, and so certainly there's been some talk of that. I think it's a great story. I mean, it's a true story, and I think that there's a lot that can be learned from it, and it's a lot of twists and turns. So certainly a production has been tossed around, and screenplay, et cetera. So you never know. I think it's a unique exposure, you know, look at the world of medicine in general, and a look at celebrity medicine.
Okay. Doctor, a final topic I want to touch on, and that is something that is in your wheelhouse, and that is the opioid epidemic that is sweeping America. It seems like we can't turn on the news or read a newspaper without hearing about it. Why is this such a problem? Obviously, it didn't appear overnight. How did it become such a problem, and what is your thought on how we can curb it?
Well, I think that, you know, in 2007, which is 10 years ago, when I was sort of in, you know, entered into my issue with what they allegedly there was illegal prescribing, et cetera, of pain medicine, we have not solved or helped curb the epidemic of deaths and issues related to the opiate crisis. The epidemic has just gotten worse. People are dying, young people are dying. So we have not attacked it in the right way. I think that shutting down pill mills and shutting down, illegal prescriptions was the right thing to do. Obviously, it was a way to cut out Florida's Oxy Alley, where people are, basically trafficking drugs, prescription medications. And those were largely shut down, and you would think that that would have had a direct effect on decreasing the opiate abuse. But sometimes when you curb, even though when you curb and stop the legal prescribing, then people go elsewhere. So it didn't my opinion is it didn't address the root issue of whether it's addiction help or identifying addicted patients and trying to intervene and offer them help to be able to get them into programs, et cetera, and have the counseling. There's a major lack of that. And also, you know, having people that are having doctors being trained in ways to effectively use pain medication sparingly and when it's indicated and having the experience to be able to do it. I think what it's done is caused a cold, sort of cold shadow over any prescribing of opiates, which legal prescribing, which I think is you know, there's definitely alternative things to use, but there is a role for it, in my opinion, to have patients who are managed. I still manage patients with chronic pain with opiates and with physical therapy and with all the other things. But the problem is that no one has the access, and it's not as we need more access to alternative methods. And we also need to address the illegal drug trade, the harder issues of illegal street drugs, and how these drugs are manufactured and artificially, and the fentanyl issue. I think bringing up another celebrity issue with Prince is death found with fentanyl in his system. Fentanyl is an opiate that is, 100 times stronger than morphine, used in the wrong way, it's deadly. And then they have artificial types that are manufactured by drug dealers. And so people are sourcing them out. Even someone with the resources of Prince may have been resourcing part of it from illegal means and maybe from legal. I don't know. But it's all, when all put together, you're looking at a disaster.
Why do you think these celebrities, they know better? I mean, they see other ones die. They hear from you guys, the doctors, the medical profession, saying this stuff isn't good. Why do they think this is okay to take this stuff?
I think that they don't necessarily consult the right doctors or the right. They just because everyone says yes to them on a lot of measures because of who they are, then they actually govern their own health care, or they just figure just get it done, like they have an assistant get it or what it is. So I think they feel in control. They don't probably seek out the right help in terms of the right physicians or the ones that are specialized, because they can just pretty much get whatever they want.
Right. You had mentioned about the fact that there are alternative measures of treating pain and dealing with things, and you do focus on prevention as opposed to cure in a lot of times. If you can catch it early, that's brought out in some of the stuff I've read on you. You have a holistic approach in a lot of things. Do you have any books out or forthcoming on that thought process about wellness and prevention versus dealing with the illness after the fact?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely, I mean, I'm very much into functional medicine, or which is basically looking at the root cause of something, even if it comes to pain. Where are we going to find that source of the root cause? And not necessarily is that a surgery. It's finding out that root cause and trying to address it from the inside out. And I absolutely would like to be able to, I'm going to probably start doing different things like podcasts and
Excellent.
Other radio things that are just, I think radio is a very effective way to have access to numerous different avenues to help educate public on basically shifting the paradigm from a sick method of treating people, disease oriented, to prevention oriented. But I think Americans, we have to take control of our health. We've been on the sidelines. And we've been a pill nation. We've been, my stomach hurts,
take an
antacid.
Right.
Take a pill for this, take a pill for that. You know, and the practice is very busy. It if someone's coming in as primary care, they want an antibiotic, and they feel it's useless to go to a doctor unless they can prescribe something. So
right.
We have to shift our paradigm to say that, well, it takes you know, here's some cough syrup that is, you know, natural, and mm-hmm. you can make it yourself with some thyme. You know, I mean, so I think the approach, I think people are ready to take back their health, and I think that that's what gives us a platform to, as physicians who are educators and in the community, to be able to express that, whether it's through books, or which I would love to write more,
mm-hmm. Or radio,
and, or have another venue, podcast,
right.
another way, just to get the public to be able to see, because there's a lot of people, a lot of physicians who are really caught up and frustrated with the current way things are running, and we're on the sidelines, but they would love to be able to reach people and, you know, and deal with things before they happen, and not only right. saves lives, but it saves money for the problem. Yeah,
education is definitely the answer to so many problems if we just take the time to look into it and look at it. Is there a website people can follow you at and read more up on you?
It is coming. I mean, it's funny because I was trying to do a marketing thing where I had, but there will be a website. If I think it's under my name, Kapoor Medical is eventually what it will be, KAPOOR medical.com. I'm working to try to figure out domains, et cetera, but that's where I'll have a platform to have podcasts and information.
Okay.
And through the Ronnie James Dio, has a website for the Cancer Foundation.
Right.
Stand Up and Shout Cancer Foundation, and I will be putting some of the cancer relevant screening on that site. In fact, we have a new UCLA study that we're supporting that is looking at developing a saliva test for stomach cancer, and that should be in the next year going to the FDA for approval.
So, all right, and look for follow-up.
We're very excited about that.
We can look for follow-ups on that at dealcancerfund.org. Doctor, thank you so much for spending time with me today. Again, the book is Trust Me, I'm a Doctor, My Life Before, During, and After, Anna Nicole Smith, coming to stores soon, currently available online at Amazon and other book retailers, and KapoorMedical.com is the website to write down that is forthcoming as well. Again, thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye. Let's play some Ronnie James Dio now. If you remember Ronnie, then stand up and shout for DioCancerFund.org. This is Holy Diver. My next guest coming up after this. Ronnie James Dio. I had the pleasure of working with him a number of times and really spent a good evening with him at Chicago's House of Blues. Sadly, he passed away in 2010 of cancer, and his memory lives on. His wife, Wendy Dio, as well as Dr. Sandy, who we just talked to, are helping out with the Ronnie James Dio Stand Up and Shout Cancer Fund. And you can follow that and find out more at www.diocancerfund.org. And again, my thanks to the doctor for joining us, Dr. Sandy. He's got a brand new book out, and I think you'll find it rather interesting. Trust me, I'm a doctor. My life before, during, and after Anna Nicole Smith. And it's quite an interesting and rather quick read, so check it out. All right, we are going to bring on another guest here in just a moment. If you're a regular listener to the show, you know he was on a few weeks ago. I'm talking about Freddie King, the blues legend's younger brother, Benny Turner. And the reason we're bringing him back is he's got a brand new album called My Brother's Blues with some very special guests. And it's a tribute to his late great brother, Freddie King. He also is being inducted into the Chicago Blues Hall of Fame. We'll find out more when we get Benny on the phone. But first, let's tap into that new album released today, Benny Turner, My Brother's Blues, and this is a track called I'm Ready. Yes, I'm ready. I'm ready to bring on my next guest, the one and only Benny Turner. If you're a regular listener to the show, you know he was on the program just a few weeks ago. We were talking about lots of things, his career. He's back because there's two reasons. He's being inducted into the Chicago Blues Hall of Fame, as I understand, and today is the day that Benny's releasing his long-awaited album, My Brother's Blues. And, of course, his famous older brother, Freddie King, one of the three kings of the blues, a true rock and roll and blues legend. And that song that we just heard was actually written by Willie Dixon, a Chicago legend in his own right. Benny, how are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you doing, Tom?
Doing great. It's only been a few weeks since we talked last, but a lot seems to be happening for you, my friend.
Yes, yes, yes. The hits keep on coming.
Now, for those that that are unfamiliar, Benny grew up in Texas, and he has a big history here in Chicagoland, which is why we're going to be inducting him soon. He was there when Freddie bought his first guitar. He was there, as you remember, he told us, when he bought his last guitar, and was there every day, pretty much in between all of that. And Freddie's been long gone. You have been doing very well, Benny, the last few years, stepping up on your own after being mentored by Magic Sam and working with so many talents over the years. You're finally your own independent solo artist, and you got a brand new album paying tribute to your roots. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. You know, I enjoyed doing this because I got to do some of the tunes that Freddie really liked, and a couple that we didn't play that often, you know. And I decided to put them on, and we had fun doing it. The band really loved it, and we loving it still. You know, like we sit down and listen and say, did we do that? Wow, man, this sounds good, you know.
Well, you've got a new book out, Survivor, that we talked about last time you were here. How is that doing?
Great, great. We had to put a brand new order in. Just put a new order in to get some more books out to people that's wanting them now.
Excellent. And again, this album, it comes out today, am I correct, My Brother's Blues?
That's right. It's released today, officially.
You've got a lot of songs on here. There's 11 songs on here. You've got some special guests. Let's talk about the impetus for doing this. At this point in your career, you've always been very proud of your brother Freddie, but this one, you really step up. It's almost like a big thank you to him.
Yes, it is. Well, it started with my mother, and I did I think the record was Journey, I believe it was. I started to, you know, recognize, have people know who we started, you know, how we started with my mother, you know.
Well, she was a singer, correct? And guitar player?
Played the guitar, yes.
Okay.
And so I did a tune on there called My Mother's Blues, and then my uncle Leon and Larry and Willie and Felix, they were all guitar players, and so I did my uncle's blues, and now it's my brother's blues.
Very good. Keeping it in the family.
Get in the family, yeah.
Now, you're going to be inducted, I'm not sure when the ceremony is. Is it this month or next month?
It's October.
October. Yeah. What was your thoughts, and how did you find out that you were going to be inducted into the Chicago Blues Hall of Fame?
Well, my manager, Sally, she informed me, and I said, what? Great. You know, and I started thinking to myself, you know, I said, a lot of guys walk up and say, I don't deserve this, but I deserve this. Yes, Lord. You know, man, you know what? I started in the early 50s. You know, running around with Freddie, and I got to know all of the greats and played with a lot of the greats, you know. And I'm still doing it, you know. And go ahead.
I was going to say, what do you think, Freddie passed at a very young age. What do you think would have developed with Freddie in his career? You were right there at his side, and you knew what he was thinking. You knew what he was doing. Where would his music have taken him?
Well, you're listening to it right now.
Okay.
Because we thought alike, you know. If I changed something, he'd follow it, go right along with it. You know, we didn't have to rehearse anything. And if I wanted to, like, we played a boogie, if I wanted to change something in the boogie, he'd go right with it, you know. And the Mojo boogie, I changed a couple of things and went right with it, you know. And that's the way we were. And right now, he would be playing most of the songs like I'm playing it right now.
Do you think he'd have stayed on the road? Did he like touring?
Yes, we liked it. You know, but toward the end, when he passed away, you know, the wind just kind of went out of my sails a little bit, you know, and I didn't want to travel anymore. But I did, after Mighty Joe Young pulled me out, and got me interested in again. And then after he died, you know, I went to New Orleans, and I didn't want to travel anymore, but I'm getting the fever again.
Now, you're living there full-time now, right? You're not in Chicago anymore.
No. No, okay. No. I'm in New Orleans full time. But while I was down there, I was doing a regular gig at B.B. King Club, and I quit that. It was a Monday and a Tuesday because I wanted to go full time, to the road.
Mm-hmm. All the Kings are gone now, Albert, B.B., and Freddie. They got quite a legacy between them. Who do you look to at this point, as far as the young generation, the new Turks, if you will, of the blues, as far as carrying on that legend,
well,
that legacy?
Well, a young man that a lot of people don't know about is Taz, His name is Brandon, and he first started playing around me when he was about 12. No, actually younger than that. And he stumbled in the club that I was playing in New Orleans, and he wanted to sit in,
Mm-hmm.
And he knocked me out, and I think they just closed on Broadway. He was, I think they called it the School of Rock, and he played in that. And he was going to play with me at the Ann Arbor Jazz Festival, that the weather didn't permit it. But guys like him will carry it on, Not only do they like it, they can play it,
Right. Now, mm-hmm. You're on NOLA Blue Records, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
So that's based out of New Orleans, then?
No. It's like, it's like two places, yes and no. She got it. It's Pennsylvania and New Orleans.
Okay. Now, this album, it's officially out today. How are you going to be getting it out there? Is it available in the brick-and-mortar record stores that still exist, or is it strictly online? How are you moving the product?
Right now it's online, and Betsy is doing that, and I really don't know where she's putting it right now.
Mm-hmm.
But BennyTurner.com, you can definitely get one.
Okay, BennyTurner.com, you can order it online. Again, there's 11 tracks here. Now, these are all songs your brother recorded and some things, like you said, you took a little freedoms with, a little creative artistic direction. How did you nail down the 11? I mean, he left such a legacy of records and great songs. How did you pick these 11?
Well, they were like my favorites, and tunes that we had fun with, and it's take the Mojo Boogie, that's not an easy song to do at J.B. Lenoir.
Mm-hmm.
And his old bass player, Robert Elam, that was his song. I mean, he could bring down the house, I'm telling you, when he did this song. And after me and Freddie got on the road, Freddie knew I liked the song, so Freddie started to do it,
Mm-hmm.
So it became a favorite. And so I had to do that, and then Have You Ever Loved a Woman, that was one of his first, these were all like favorites of both of ours. And It's Your Move, this one, we didn't do it that much on the set, but Freddie loved Big Leg Woman.
Okay.
And he would always do Big Leg Woman to start off his set. And so I decided, I'm going to bring Freddie up, and we changed the Come On song, we'll put in This Your Move. So we introduced, Freddie's ready. Are you ready for Freddie? Bring Freddie up. Doo, 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 doo. And we started to play the song, and killed it. He came up, and it was like the first song, that we did. And he knew everything about the song, although we'd never played the song before.
Mm-hmm.
Recorded it and never played it. But he remembered, and he came up and he played it. And you would think it was the best song of the night. And he, after it was over, he backed all the way back to me, and he said, whispered in my ear, Big Leg Woman. So I couldn't change it. So, he loved Big Leg Woman. I like the element. So that's how those two ended up on there.
For the listeners out there that want to learn more about Freddie King and Benny Turner and the whole scene during that era, Benny's new book is out. It's only been out a couple of months. It's really a good read. It's called Survivor, The Benny Turner Story, written with Bill Dahl, a great blues writer, journalist. And it's an amazing read. Now, Bill's still out of Chicago, isn't he?
Yes, he is. Uh-huh.
And the book has been doing very well. It's very much a chronicle, I guess you'd say, of your life. And your life ran in tandem with Freddie's, so it's his story, too.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And now this album seems to be a perfect accompaniment to it. My Brother's Blues out today.
Yes, it is.
You have some special guests on this album. Roosevelt Collier, Marilyn Wonderland, and of course, someone that's very familiar to those of us here in the Chicago blues scene is Otis Clay, one of the greats out there. You do a song with him. I'm Tore Down. How did you get the special guest? What was the story behind recruiting who you got?
Well, I was playing with Marva Wright at the time I recorded it.
Okay.
And Marva said, "Benny, I want to do something on your record, you know." And I thought about it, and I said, "Yeah, this is perfect. You know, you can do Tore Down." And so me and Otis was, you know, we get on the phone back and forth, you know, because we had already did a hit gospel called "When the Gates Swing Open," you know. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about doing another one, you know. And so I said, maybe Otis might want to do something. So I called Otis, and I said, "Yeah, man, yeah." So I went to Chicago. And Otis had a studio in his house. And we went there and we played around with it. Man, we loved it. And so that's how he ended up on it.
Excellent. We're going to play that as we get ready to say goodbye. Is there anything that we haven't touched on, Benny? And again, I appreciate you coming back so soon after your last visit. But I did want to touch on the fact that you're being inducted. I think that's a great honor and definitely deserved. And, of course, this album deserves a lot of attention, My Brother's Blues. What have we not talked on you'd like to let listeners know?
You know, like you said, the person they all we got, Joe Crown, who I have great respect for, played on the keys. And, I mean, he did a tremendous job on the piano. He had Keiko Gamaki on the keys. She did a great job. Jelly Bean Jeffrey Alexander, he's going to be with me. We're going to come to Chicago, and we're going to play Roses. I don't know the date, but it's called Roses.
Is that coming up during the induction, during October?
I think it is going to be in October.
Okay.
And I want to invite everybody out there to you know, meet and greet these fine musicians, you know, and like people I haven't seen in a long time. I'd like to see them, you know. Freddie Dixon, you know, he's a good friend. I'd like to see him. And I can go down the line, you know, a lot of my old friends have passed away now, you know,
right.
From the 50s.
Right.
You know, we don't have that many. And I'm just looking forward to having a good night. Eddie Shaw. And I'd like to see him.
Eddie and the Wolf, what was it? The Wolf Pack, wasn't it?
The Wolfgang.
Wolfgang, yeah. I haven't seen him in years. Boy, that's another great talent.
Yeah, he's one of the old timers. And I enjoy seeing Eddie. Eddie's like one of those guys that you sit down and you can talk about old times, like B.B.
Right.
King, he loved to talk about old times with, you know, with people that was back in. At that time that he can relate to, you know, he loved that, you know,
right.
So do I.
Well, again, thank you, sir, for joining us. I hope to have you back on the show again real soon. Congratulations on the induction and on a great new album.
Well, thank you, sir. I hope to see you soon.
This is Benny Turner. A little help here from Marva Wright and Otis Clay on the vocals with Benny. This is I'm Tore Down. It's off the new album, My Brother's Blues.
Jump in! sight. I'm there for you if you want me to. Swear I don't believe that your love is true.
Great show that was. Benny Turner closing us out there with a song off his latest album, My Brother's Blues. Before that, Dr. Sandy Kapoor talking about opiate addiction and talking about his new book, Trust Me, I'm a Doctor, My Life Before, During, and After, Anna Nicole Smith. And, of course, the whole first half of the show, Mitch Michaels, a Chicago radio legend, and Ken Cirilla, his co-author on the book, Doing the Cruise. I'm Tom Lounges. Thank you, as always, for joining me for another edition of Midwest Beats and supporting Lakeshore Public Radio. I'll catch you on the rebound Tuesday night. We'll have another great guest.